Arrivo. So last week we read forty. So today we'll read text 41 on page 78. Maya hi yasya jagat andashatani sute. Traigunya tadvishaya veda vitaya mana sattvavalambi parasattvang vishuddha sattvang govindam adipurushang tamahang bhajami. Please repeat. Maya, the external potency. He, indeed. Yasya, of whom? Jagat anda, of universes. Shatani, hundreds. Sute, brings forth. Traigunya, embodying the threefold mundane qualities. Tat, of that. Vishaya, the subject matter. Veda, the Vedic knowledge. Vitayamana, diffusing. Sattva avalambi, the support of all existence. Parasattvang, the ultimate entity. Vishuddhasattvam, the absolute substantive principle. Govindam, Govinda. Adipurusham, the original person. Tam, him. Aham, I. Pajami, worship. Translation. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is the absolute substantive principle, being the ultimate entity in the form of the support of all existence, whose external potency embodies the threefold mundane qualities, namely sattva, rajas, and tamas, and diffuses the Vedic knowledge regarding the mundane world. Please repeat. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is the absolute substantive principle, being the ultimate entity in the form of the support of all existence, whose external potency embodies the threefold mundane qualities, namely sattva, rajas, and tamas, and diffuses the Vedic knowledge regarding the mundane world. Purport. The active mundane quality of rajas brings forth or generates all mundane entities. The quality of sattva, mundane manifestative principle, in conjunction with rajas, stands for the maintenance of the existence of entities that are so produced, and the quality of tamas represents the principle of destruction. The substantive principle, which is mixed with the threefold mundane qualities, is mundane, while the unmixed substance is transcendental. The quality of eternal existence is the principle of absolute entity. The person whose proper form abides in that essence is alone the unalloyed entity, non-mundane, supermundane, and free from all mundane quality. He is cognitive bliss. It is the deluding energy who has elaborated the regulative knowledge Vedas bearing on the threefold mundane quality. So, this is all very high technical stuff, but we have to understand these three qualities. Everything mundane, that is everything that's not absolute, that's not transcendental, that's not beyond time and space, that's not beyond duality, everything that's mundane, all the things we see in this world, are composed of these three qualities. So, I think modern science doesn't think in terms of qualities so much anymore. They're looking in terms of, matter and energy. And the idea of qualitative knowledge of the qualities of substances is kind of seen as some part of Aristotelian old-fashioned science from the Middle Ages or something like that. But actually, we can understand that there are qualities in the world, qualities that we experience These are actual, they're actual properties of reality. And the quality of ignorance, the quality of passion, and the quality of goodness are the three basic qualities. And then they have different mixtures: goodness, passion, goodness, ignorance, passion, 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 goodness, passion, ignorance, and so forth. So 3 times 3 is 9, 9 times 9 is 81, 81 times 81 is a big number, and like 6,561 or something like that. And it goes on and on like that. There's actually 8,400,000 different species of life. Each species, a type of body, is, you know, a precise mixture of different combinations of these three qualities. And the basic principles of these qualities are described, that Rajas is the creative principle, and it's, these characters are explained in Bhagavad Gita in the 14th chapter. The quality of Rajas is characterized by striving for something difficult to obtain, working hard. You know, you were going to say? Microphone? Creation, right? Brahma.
Brahma creates.
Yeah, he creates he's the Prajapati that creates all of the different generations of the men and the demigods and the demons and the all the different things in the world. He's like the architect of the universe. Earlier in this book, it was describing how Lord Shiva creates, because he creates although he's the principle of destruction, by his interaction with the mundane procreative energy, he creates the faculty of perverted cognition. He creates the condition for material existence. And Lord Vishnu creates as Mahavishnu, because all the universes are exiting from him. But he doesn't personally interact with mundane nature. He prefers to consort with his internal energy. So he's simply dreaming. He doesn't have any direct... He glances, right? He impregnates the material nature by his glance, and that glance is Shambhu, the principle of Shiva, who is also the predominating deity, guna avatar of the mode of ignorance, because everything that's mundane has a destruction, has a temporary period of time. So he's, as the guna avatar of the mode of goodness, he's the support of all existence. He maintains, because he is eternal, because the very principle of truth or goodness is to be eternal, to be beyond the mundane. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam says that although the sages who are on the path of liberation, they don't envy anyone, and they're very respectful to all of the demigods, nevertheless, they do not worship the ghastly forms of the demigods like Mahabhairava Kali and so forth, but they worship Vishnu because he is the predominating deity of the mode of goodness. Mumukshava Gaura Rupan Hitva Bhuta Patinata Narayana Parak Sarve Yajanti Hyanusuyavaha. Is it? No, I think I got that wrong. We have a shloka books, right? And I wonder if it's in here. 1, 2, 20. Let's see. Mumukshava Gaura Rupan Hitva Bhuta Patinata Narayana Kalak Shanta Bhajanti Hyanusuyavaha. That's how it goes. I don't think it's going to be in here. No. It skips from 1, 2, 21 to 1, 2, 28. Yeah, why don't you hand me a first canto, part one? We still have a whole bunch of them. Okay, that big one will work. So 1, 2, Well, let me read you this whole is about five verses or something, starting at 1-23. The transcendental personality of Godhead is indirectly associated with the three modes of material nature, namely passion, goodness, and ignorance. And just for the material world's creation, maintenance, and destruction, he accepts the three qualitative forms of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Of these three, all human beings can derive ultimate benefit from Vishnu, the form of the quality of goodness. Firewood is a transformation of earth, but smoke is better than raw wood, and fire is still better. So for those of you who are getting books now, we're in the first canto, second chapter, starting on verse 23, and now I'm reading verse 24. In this book, it's page 125, but I don't know what it is in that book. 125, same. Firewood is a transformation of earth, but smoke is better than raw wood. And fire is still better, for by fire we can derive the benefits of superior knowledge through Vedic sacrifices. Similarly, passion, rajas, is better than ignorance, tamas. But goodness, sattva, is the best, because by goodness one can come to realize the absolute truth. Previously, all the great sages rendered service unto the personality of Godhead due to his existence above the three modes of material nature. They worshipped him to become free from material conditions and thus derive the ultimate benefit. Whoever follows such great authorities is also eligible for liberation from the material world. Those who are serious about liberation are certainly non-envious, and they respect all, yet they reject the horrible and ghastly forms of the demigods and worship only the all-blissful forms of Lord Vishnu and his plenary portions. Those who are in the modes of passion and ignorance worship the forefathers, other living beings, and the demigods who are in charge of cosmic activities, for they are urged by a desire to be materially benefited with women, wealth, power, and progeny. In the revealed scriptures, the ultimate object of knowledge is Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead. The purpose of performing sacrifice is to please him. Yoga is for realizing him. All fruitive activities are ultimately rewarded by him only. He is supreme knowledge, and all severe austerities are performed to know him. Religion, dharma, is rendering loving service unto him. He is the supreme goal of life. So, of the threefold qualities, they're all mundane. Even the quality of goodness in the form of maintenance of material existence is mixed. It's not pure. It's not Vishuddha Sattva. But only that pure goodness is actually transcendental to time and space. And in that state of pure goodness, free from contact of passion and ignorance, then one can gain positive scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead. So the Bhagavatam is comparing raw wood is like the mode of ignorance. And then when it begins smoking, that's like the mode of passion. But if it's blazing fire, that's like the mode of goodness. And from the fire, we can obtain benefits, because with fire, we can perform sacrifice. We offer things into the fire. So this analogy, similarly, that we have to be elevated from the mode of ignorance and the mode of passion to the mode of goodness. In that mode of goodness, we get darshan of the absolute truth. So Krishna tells Arjuna that the Vedas deal mainly with the three modes of material nature, the actions and interactions of how material nature works, and that he advises Arjuna to rise above those modes, to become a yogi, not to become a fruitive actor who's busy trying to get material benefits by performing sacrifices according to Karmakanda section of the Vedas, and then, you know, like going to higher planets or you know, having better progeny, power, fame, and better life in this life or the next life. But rather to become dedicated, fixed in purpose, dedicated in intelligence, one-pointed in intelligence. He says that those in the minds of those who are too attached to material opulence and sense enjoyment, then the one-pointed determination for self-realization doesn't take place. Bhogaishvarya prasaktanam tayaparita chetasam vyavasayatmaka buddhir. What is it? Samadho navadhiyate. So trigunya vishaya veda nishtrigunya bhavarjana nirdvandva nitvasattvasto niryogakshema atmavan. So all the purposes that are served by the small bodies of water can similarly be served by the great oceans or great lakes and so forth. So similarly, the one who knows the absolute truth, the form of the mode of goodness, Supreme Personality of Godhead, one who chants Hare Krishna and absorbs himself in the pure mode of goodness, is not bereft of any of the results of those who study the three modes of material nature and the various different branches of Vedic knowledge. And this devotional service is so strong that one who actually takes seriously to devotional service will automatically find his way. Or I think Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, one can run with their eyes closed in this path of bhakti, meaning that ordinarily people have to have a lot of knowledge of Vedic principles of righteousness and proper behavior and all these things, and very carefully find their way through, with examining and seeing very carefully. But one who actually just surrenders to Krishna and chants Hare Krishna, even if they don't have so much knowledge, they will achieve success. And they'll get what knowledge they need. Krishna promises that he gives the knowledge in their hearts, dadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam boyantate. To those who are constantly devoted and worship him with love, he destroys ignorance in their hearts and gives them the knowledge. Ananyaschintayantomang yejanak paripasate tesham nityabhyuktanam yogakshemam vahamyaham. Srila Prabhupada translates this yogakshemam in this context as preserving what they have and supplying what they lack. So
this is the logo of LIC in India.
Say that again. Play with the microphone.
This is the Yogakshemam Vahamyaham is the logo of one insurance company in India, LIC.
LIC.
In the logo they put Yogakshemam Vahamyaham.
That's
whatever we preserve and whatever you leg we after death.
That's someone should tell State Farm they have a new advertising campaign where their agent appears and just grants all the wishes of everybody. Usually everyone is, I don't know if you've seen this, everyone is wishing for, the men are wishing for an attractive woman, the women are wishing for an attractive man, and so they get in a car accident and they, like, you know how the Aladdin rubs the bottle and gets a genie, you know, so they say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there, and then the insurance agent appears, and then all of a sudden they start granting them the object of their desired mating propensity or whatever. But but it's good at least they're remembering Bhagavad Gita in their logo. But so let's see. Any more discussion? Anyone have any questions, comments, discussion about this verse? Mayahi asya jagadanda shatani sute trigunya tadvishaya veda vitayamana sattvavalambi parasattvang vishuddha sattvang govindamadi purushang tamahang pajami. He's the ultimate entity in the form of the support of all existence and is the absolute substantive principle. So that which is pure goodness, transcendental, is beyond the threefold qualities of creation and maintenance and annihilation. She, please.
So, Prabhuji, when we talk about the Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu and Mahesh. So Brahma is the creator and Vishnu is the sustainer?
Yes.
Maintainer, and Shiva is the destroyer?
Yes.
And so here they were talking about that sattva is linked with, sattva is mundane manifested principle. So that is creation. Sattva would
Rajas
be creation.
Brings forth or generates all mundane activities. So the quality of sattva in conjunction with rajas is the mundane manifested principle. The quality of sattva when it's completely pure with no mixture with rajas and tamas is the transcendental principle of the basis of the spiritual world or the absolute. So that's what, when he's saying the quality of sattva, mundane manifestive principle, he's referring to the mixed sattva, which is the principle of preservation within the material world.
And that is Brahma.
No, that is Vishnu.
That is Vishnu, so mixed with rajas, maybe Vishnu. Okay.
There's Brahma is the guna avatar of passion. And Vishnu is the guna avatar of goodness.
Yes. Okay.
And Shiva is the guna avatar of tamas. And as the guna avatar of goodness in the material world, Vishnu is representing the mixed goodness that is the principle of maintenance of mundane entities, which are created by rajas and destroyed by tamas. So then they endure for some time, and so he's the principle of maintenance. But we can see that the principle of maintenance by itself stands for eternality. Maintenance without creation and destruction is eternal, and that is transcendental Vishnu, who is Narayan, who is Govinda. So that's what this is talking about, that Govinda is the absolute substantive principle, and he's the support of all. His external potency embodies the threefold mundane qualities. So I don't know if that clarifies.
Also in 14th chapter, it says, I think 9th or 10th sloka, it says there is always competition of superiority between sattva guna, rajaguna and tamaguna.
Right.
So how do you examine that, who is superior? Or how do they compete? Or
Sometimes
give some example.
Sometimes rajaguna becomes prominent, defeating sattva guna and tamaguna. Sometimes tamaguna becomes prominent, defeating rajaguna and sattvaguna. Sometimes sattvaguna becomes prominent. The example is in the brahmana, the sattvaguna is prominent, right? When in the kshatriya, the rajaguna is prominent. And, you know, you could say in the shudra, the tamaguna is prominent, or in the animal, or when tamaguna becomes prominent, we go to sleep. We feel bewildered. In all of us, we're experiencing, in our mundane experience, influence of sattva, rama, rajas, and tama, guna. When we become enlightened and everything is clear and we have very clear perception and knowledge and happiness, that's because sattva guna has become prominent in our psyche. And when we become, hopefully we don't, but if we become intensely desiring something and striving very hard, determined to, get straight A's or get a promotion at work or whatever, we're determined. That's because, the sattva, the rajaguna is becoming prominent. And the tamaguna we experience when we feel very tired, we want to go to sleep, we become bewildered, confused, we can't think straight, and we sleep, that's because the tamaguna is becoming prominent. But the end of the chapter, the conclusion of the chapter, Krishna explains the position of one who's always engaged in devotional service, that they're unattached. When enlightenment and delusion and could I have the Bhagavad Gita? And passion present themselves, it doesn't disturb them. And because they've transcended the three modes and they're still absorbed in devotional service. that by engaging in pure devotional service without deviation, one transcends the three modes of material nature. That's how to transcend it. In fact, I heard one class when Srila Prabhupada was saying that this whole Krishna consciousness movement is meant for keeping us out of the touch of the three modes of material nature. He said, if you're in the middle of the ocean and there's no boat around or anything, it's a very dangerous condition. Eventually you will drown, you know, if you're stuck in the middle of the ocean. But if someone just comes up and lifts you just 3 or 4 inches above the water, then you're safe. You can breathe, you know, you can float above the water. So he said that this Hare Krishna movement is to keep us above the ocean of these three modes of material nature. So Krishna says, well, Arjuna asked the question, oh, my dear Lord, by which symptoms is one known who is transcendental to the three modes? What is his behavior and how does he transcend the modes of nature? And Krishna says, O son of Pandu, he who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear. So attachment, you know, when you're thinking like, I'm trying to lose weight, but sometimes I may think, oh, I just have to eat that, something sweet or something like that. That's an example of, you know, an attachment that's trying to pull me away from my duty of eating what I'm supposed to be eating. So one who does not hate them when they appear, when they're present, or long for them when they disappear, who is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities, remaining neutral and transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active. That is, the material world is full of all kinds of actions, reactions, you know, everything is turbulent and changing, but spiritual existence is peaceful. There's activity there also, there's very blissful activity, but it's not the kind of activity that we're familiar with here. It's not the kind, there's variety there, but it's not the kind of variety where everything, where there's competition, and it's not, the variety and activity in the spiritual world is not contaminated by these qualities, mundane qualities, and therefore it exists on a plane of non-duality and absolute peacefulness and enlightenment. So, so you know that the modes alone are active, that you see that, you know, in all the material world of creation and destruction, it's the action of the modes, and we're not the doers. The actual soul, the identity is different from that. I used to chant japa on the beach a lot. You know, when I lived over there, I would go in the morning and chant japa and watch the sunrise and on the, you know, chanting in the ocean, waving, and I would feel how the waves are coming in, you know, and the material universe is like breathing almost, you know, it's constantly something, there's always another wave coming in and coming out, and the wind is blowing and things are going on. And, you know, I feel like the holy name is transcendental to all that. It's immovable, fixed, you know. It's full of its own emotional rasa and juice, but it's beyond this temporary world of creation and destruction, like that. So in this material world, our bodies are doing things, but we're not these bodies, you know. We're not the doers. This is all being, our senses, our mind are all interacting according to the modes of nature. And we, the real identity, we are observing. And our function is to serve Krishna, not to serve these, not to serve this desires that are arising in our, you know, from our senses and mind and so forth. So, who is situated in the self and regards alike happiness and distress, who looks upon a lump of earth, a stone, and a piece of gold with an equal eye, who is equal toward the desirable and the undesirable, who is steady, situated equally well in praise and blame, honor and dishonor, who treats alike both friend and enemy, and who has renounced all material activities, such a person is said to have transcended the modes of nature. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains, Arjuna has asked three different questions. He said, by what symptoms is one known who's transcendental to the modes? What? How does he behave? And how does he transcend the modes of nature? So he's answering them one after another. And so now he answers the first two questions. And then in the next verse, one who engages in full devotional service, unfailing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman. Haribol Prabhu, please take some prasadam before you do. Hare Krishna. What's your good name? Mahesh, Haribol. You have to go? Okay, take some prasadam with you before you go. One who engages in full devotional service, unfailing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature and then comes to the level of Brahman. And I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman, which is immortal, imperishable and eternal, and is the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. Haribol, you have to go?
Yes, but I have to take my son for skating.
Oh, okay, Haribol. Roller skating or ice skating?
Roller skating.
Okay. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, two questions. One is regarding this modes of material nature that you just described. You said everything is a play of modes of material nature, and another place Krishna said there is always competition between these three modes. So, for example, there are two points here. One is two cases. One is something that is external to us, and the second one is something that is internal to us. For example, let's say there is a severe cold and there is no heater, and we have to sleep on that day without heater and it's cold, and it's an external condition. It's a mode, that's a play of modes of nature, but it's external condition. It's nothing to do with us, but we have to suffer. That is one case. The second case, that I am able to understand it, you know, in that way, in that case, we are supposed to tolerate it without being too much disturbed. But the second case, something that is internal to us, for example, as Krishna said, there is always a competition between these three modes. For example, laziness can come in, or we may want to sleep more than needed, or are doing things that are not favorable to the devotional service. So these are infected with different modes. So when we say there is always a competition between modes. Does it only apply? Should be applied to the internal case also, right?
Well, what you're calling the internal case
is
actually still external to us. It seems like we can't see it with our senses. Mm-hmm. We can't see the thought in our minds, but the thought but when we're chanting japa, that's when we can experience how our mind is deviating from the holy name, and we have to bring it back. So then we can start to perceive that our mind is also external to us. We're the self who's pulling it back, right? And we're our nature is to be chanting with pure devotion, but the mind's nature is to be, wandering to something else. So, in the European tradition, they have the Cartesian split, the idea that that which is material is that which we can perceive. It has extension, it has motion, it's matter, and it can be measured and analyzed in terms of mathematical relationships of, laws of nature. And then the idea, the world of thought and emotion and so forth, according to Descartes, because it doesn't have extension, it doesn't have three dimensions and so forth, it's considered to be mind and part of this second substance. There's the material substance, and then there's this mental substance, which he identifies with spirit. But actually, that mental substance is also material. It also has a beginning and an end, thoughts arise and then they disappear. So according to Bhagavad Gita, you know, there's a parashakti and an aparashakti, a superior energy which is internal and an inferior energy which is external and separated from Krishna. And the external energy includes these features of the psyche called mind, intelligence, and false ego. So those feelings of laziness or hankering or happiness even, because material mode of goodness also conditions one by a sense of happiness, a feeling that I'm superior to others, that I have, that I understand things and I'm peaceful and all right, you know. Those are also external to our real spiritual identity. And the real spiritual identity, what is it? Jivera Swarup Hoy Krishna Nitya Das. It's a loving servant of Krishna. By nature, Srila Prabhupada would also say sometimes, you know, the impersonalist philosophy, they say, oh, I'm not material, I'm a spirit soul, I'm something which is eternal, I'm beyond time and space. But they don't know how to act as a spirit soul. The spirit soul also has its own activity, and that activity is devotional service, bhakti. And when that's the completion of self-realization. If you get far enough in self-realization to realize I'm not this body, I'm not this mind, I'm eternal, I'm spiritual, you know, I belong to spiritual existence, and you're no longer attached to becoming involved in material activities. But if you haven't completed the course, you haven't realized what your actual activity is as servant of Krishna in one of the five major rasas, then there's every chance that you will fall down again. This aruya krishna parang padang tito padantito nadrita yusmadang raya. You have to go to the next stage. Like the four kumaras, they were situated in this Brahman realization, but then when they smelled the fragrance of the tulsi and sandalwood on the lotus feet of Lord Narayan at the gates of Vaikuntha, then finally they were able to become devotees. So, I don't know if I answer your question, but...
No, you answered, Prabhuji, but I have another follow-up question for this question, which is I'm still having difficulty to understand the competition between the modes, because we are talking as if the modes are something different from the soul. For example, let's say someone is situated in Suddha Sattva, that is, he is transcendental. Or maybe someone is situated in goodness, for example. But even then, that means he's in the mode of goodness. But how can we say that, again, there is a competition between different modes? That means he's in the mode of goodness, but again, he can be forced to act in the mode of passion and ignorance?
Well, if he's in the material mode of goodness, he's still influenced by... ignorance and passion, but less so than others. Mode of goodness has become prominent in this competition. So you know, he may be very pure and clean and acting as good brahmana, but it's not that he doesn't have to go to sleep at night. You know, but a pure devotee, even when he goes to sleep at night, he's dreaming of Krishna. I think I told you a couple of weeks ago, I was hearing this tape with Srila Prabhupada, and someone asked, you know, how can you chant Hare Krishna 24 hours a day? And he said, if I go to bed hungry, I sometimes dream that I'm honoring prasadam. Uh-huh. And someone is supplying me more and more. I forget what it is, paratas. And it's very nice. I'm doing this devotional service, taking these paratas, and I don't get full, and I can keep taking them. But he's saying that, you know, for someone who's a steady, who's learned to become a steady devotee, or who is eternally liberated and doesn't have to learn, but one who practices sadhana well enough, will find that even when we're, you know, because we're thinking of Krishna while we're doing our service, then even when we're sleeping, we're thinking of Krishna. Usually my mind, I don't know how it is with you, but my mind always has some music going on in it. So if it doesn't have chanting Hare Krishna, it will have some other, you know, music, that tape recording playing of something I heard, some popular music or some advertising, you know, jingle or something going on. So if I, you know, stay Krishna conscious and do service 24 hours a day, then I'm always hearing Hare Krishna chanting. And while I'm sleeping also, when I'm dreaming, I'm waking up, I'm hearing Hare Krishna chanting. Yes, Prabhuji, Krishna Purushottama.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Yes. I have this doubt, like, even though people are in mode of goodness, like, some people are very in mode of goodness, it's very tough to preach to them. You know, like myself and my brother was discussing yesterday, like, even though if you tell them to chant Hare Krishna, and they said, we are also already doing so many rituals and pujas, so there is no need of chanting, like, like, I went to Udupi and...
So what you can ask them, why do you do the rituals and pujas?
That's why I didn't ask them.
So why they do it should be to please Krishna. Yeah. And if they're doing all these rituals and pujas to please Krishna, then, and they love Krishna, then why not chant his names? When someone loves someone, they're always thinking of their lover, they're always thinking of their name. When they hear the name, it's pleasant, it's like being present, especially Krishna's name. Because my name... it's not the same as me, you know. You can't just pronounce my name and I'll be there. But, you know, but Krishna's name is actually the same as Krishna. So if you love Krishna, you're always chanting his name. So actually, you chanting Hare Krishna will make the perfection of all your pujas and rituals. Otherwise, they won't be successful, really. Even in all the Vedic rituals and things, the syllable Om must be pronounced, you know, somehow or another Krishna is present in some way. By that presence, it's gradually purifying them. But the real thing is the devotional service. So that's devotional service is transcendental. Therefore, Krishna advises Arjuna, Trigunya Vishaya Veda, right? It's called the Vedavada Ratas, that Avipashchitaha. They're not completely pure in their intelligence. And so they're thinking, we'll perform these rituals so we'll get, you know, good progeny or moksha. But yeah, he says, but in the second chapter, he says, Yam imang pushpitang vachang pravedanti avipashchita. Kriya vishesha bahulam. Bhogaishwarya Gating Prati. It's so 2:42 and 43. White Honda is blocking the parking. Someone in the kitchen. Men of small knowledge who are very much attracted to the flowery words of the Vedas, which recommend various fruitive activities for elevation to heavenly planets, result in good birth, power, and so forth. Being desirous of sense gratification and opulent life, they say that there is nothing more than this. So preaching to people in mode of goodness may be difficult, but preaching to people in mode of ignorance is more difficult. In mode of passion is more difficult. Because at least in the mode of goodness, you know, one has some ability to perceive spiritual truth. And, you know, like in the mode of goodness, at least one accepts the authority of Vedic literature. One will accept the authority of Bhagavad Gita. Preaching is always hard, you know, and people have to have causeless mercy to understand Krishna. Yeah, go ahead.
Prabhuji, I was just commenting that people who are in the mode of goodness because they are doing ritualistic activities and they are thinking that they are good. They are ignorant people in the mode of goodness.
Yeah, there's a mixture of ignorance and passion. They may be, they may be mayaya purita jnana. They may have knowledge, but it's stolen by illusion because they're proud. Generally, people who are very well educated are proud of their knowledge, and they don't realize that all that knowledge won't be with them all the time. You know, like I said, they also have to go to sleep at night. You know, they also, and in their dream, you know, I dream a lot and I pay attention, and I notice a lot of times in my dream I see the thing, there's things that are written down, and I've been trying to actually read what it says, and it's, you can't read it. It's, you know, like I have the knowledge. Anyway, I'm this is too much of a distraction or a tangent, but I've been
I've been fooling around in my lucid dreaming and realizing that, you know, you think, oh, there's a book and it's writing, but I say, okay, let me see the letters, and you can't see the letters. But yeah, so sorry to be to get distracted.
One devotee was mentioning, Prabhu, like most of the temples is gone. We have it in cities, major cities. And if you come to India, also the same case. They say that it's very easy to get devotees in cities. If you go to like few devotees or preachers in villages and towns, it takes long time to make devotees. So that was experience, because in the towns, there are little more of goodness. There is no much passion. Mm-hmm. In city, there are a lot of passion. They will become devotees fast.
Ah.
That was like experience. But if you go to village, that's a pure goodness. They're also becoming fast. But the people in towns, they're in ignorance and goodness. It takes very long time to become devotees.
Mm. The chanting of Hare Krishna, it's transcendental to the three modes. And so if somehow someone becomes attracted to the chanting, they get a little bit of experience of getting it, you know, transcendental to the three modes. But then we still have our modes of nature. They're still with us. But if we can engage constantly in devotional service, we can be like three inches above the ocean. But otherwise, you know, we still have to deal with the world. You know, if we can get these villages, if we can be there for a long time and get to be part of how the whole life goes in the village and move the village toward chanting Hare Krishna, you know, everybody in the village is working, grow some crops, do some things, you know. So if they can all be chanting Hare Krishna and be using some portion of their wealth in doing some kind of service, being sympathetic with the preaching movement, and also using some for worship of Krishna, and then
we have 10 villages.
Uh-huh.
Each village we have at least 20 families chanting Hare Krishna, and they're all simple. They do service of their own, small agriculture, and they're chanting Hare Krishna.
And they're happy in the happy. Yeah. Where are these villages?
In Andhra Pradesh.
Uh-huh.
South India. Uh-huh. Especially there's one village in Ongole near Andhra Pradesh. They're like a whole village, like 60 families are chanting Hare Krishna. All are fishermen by unfortunate. They're devotees, but they do fishing. There is no occupation. So we're trying to get some agriculture and helping them.
Mm-hmm.
Like now 20 families are doing agriculture. Uh-huh. But still they're in fishing. They go to fish whole night, they'll chant 64 rounds.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. They sleep in the boat. When they'll put the net, they have to sleep whole one day in the ocean. They'll chant 64 rounds.
That's nice. You know, they can't get initiated because they have to do that as their living. But still, you know, that's their lot in life. Krishna must understand, you know, that... I mean...
It's like it took a while to just... because we're confused. It's their occupation. Because there's livelihood.
We all run into the trouble of, you know, how do we maintain our families? How do we feel, you know, how do we get enough food to eat and those kind of things? We don't need everything that we think we need. You know, we're used to living in cities here. We think we need... You know, satellite television with 300 channels and a car that has automatic, all these different things, navigation system, and you know. But you know, when I was young, a lot of young people were like wanting to move to a simple life, like to give up the civilization, move to a farm, and then we would move to a Krishna temple. And we were happy to have no property, you know, because we were interested in living in a society that didn't have everybody fighting over money and things like that. So we would all move into the temple, and the temple was organized like a commune, like a little village. But the business of the village was just preaching, going on Harinam and book distribution every day, and then having deity worship and a place for people to come and see the temple. But our whole idea was to propagate Krishna consciousness And I was, you know, unmarried man, a brahmachari, so I didn't have to worry about how to make money at all. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any, you know, I had whatever property, you know, they gave me a toothbrush and, you know, whatever, a bowl so that I could eat it when they were serving prasadam and wash my bowl. But, you know, but I didn't feel any want, you know. But then when you get married and you're going to have to protect children and things like that, you have to somehow earn money, and so you have to have some occupation. It's not a disqualification from devotional service. In all these four ashramas and four varnas, one who actually worships Krishna with the fruits of his work can achieve the perfection of Krishna consciousness.
I was just going to say to congratulate the two brothers on the phenomenal service that they are doing, like, you know, trying to move somebody away from fishing and you know, putting them into agriculture. That's awesome. So, and I was also commenting on I read somewhere that when you chant mantras, chanting mantra outside is better than chanting them inside, and chanting them in water is even better than chanting outside.
Oh.
And I was just thinking about the fishermen.
It reminds me of a story in the Chaitanya Charitamrita where Lord Chaitanya was... he was so much in ecstasy all the time that he was, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. And he would hurt himself if the devotees didn't protect him. So they kept him in one room, this room that's there, still there in Jagannath Puri, the Gambhira place, part of the, close to the compound of the temple and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's house. They would lock him in so that he couldn't get into trouble for himself, but somehow he would get out, you know, through the keyhole somehow. He would get out. And he had a servant staying with him all the time to protect him, but somehow or another, sometimes he would get out. And so when he would get out, they would go looking for him and they would be nervous about what would happen. And sometimes they would find him in a cow pasture. He had, in ecstasy, he withdrew all his limbs. Actually, they came into his body like a tortoise, you know, that his big long body became short as he pulled his arms and legs into his body in this ecstasy. And one time, they were looking for him and looking for him, and he sometimes would run down along the side of the Bay of Bengal there on the sea, thinking it to be the Jamuna River, and, you know, seeing the sand dunes as Govardhan Hill or whatever. So they came down to look for him at the ocean, and he had become elongated. Hare Krishna, the places in his joints where the bones would join together, the ligaments or whatever that hold them together became slack, and there was like space between all of his bones, so that he was like 11 feet. Already he was always tall, you know, almost 7 feet tall, and now he was like 11 feet long, and he was floating in the sea like that. So one fisherman was there and he caught him in the net. Lord Chaitanya had just been floating in the sea and the fisherman caught him in the net. So he said, I was pulling my net in and I saw this, you know, this big fish, and it turned out to be this giant long man. You know, he was unconscious. And he said that when I go out at night, I'm afraid. I chant these Nisringadev mantras to protect me from ghosts. But this man must have a ghost, because when I touched him, my mind became very mad. And he said, I tried to protect myself by chanting my Nisringadev mantra, but it made it even worse. Because he was actually being affected by prema, by touching Lord Chaitanya. So the devotees, you know, pacified the fishermen and they took Lord Chaitanya away. That just reminded me. But yeah, it's nice that, you know, if they earn their living by fishing, and if you can find some other way that's practical, that can actually earn their living without committing the sinful activity of killing the fish, and, you know, which...
5 acres
long. Oh, nice. Very nice. Jai.
10 devotees.
Oh, wonderful. So Ramananda Sakha, then we should get to go on to the...
I just want to say, you know, for the callers on the phone, if there are any callers on the phone, you can speak at any time by first unmuting your phone by pressing *6, and then you may say whatever you like, and then mute your phone again by pressing *6 again.
Yeah, please, we want to hear from the callers on the phone just to say that you're there. Okay. Who's there?
You might have muted yourself. We are not able to hear you. Just unmute it again.
Oh, yeah, Prabhu. This is Damodar Vamsidharida.
Hari Bol, Damodar.
Hey, Krishna, Prabhu. This is very nice.
Oh, yeah. It's nice that we can have a class.
Hi, Krishna, Prabhu. Hansapriya, yogi and flicker.
Oh, Hari Bol.
Hari Bol.
We can hear the echo when I'm talking. When you have the mute off, you can hear me. But there's a time delay.
Yeah, there's a time delay.
Do you have any comments or questions? Anyone on the phone?
No comments, no questions.
Okay, we have one question.
We have one question.
From inside the temple.
From inside the temple.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, Dandavat Pranams. Mine is a just basic question. The other day when I was hearing the Bhakti Shastri class, there was a discussion about Krishna, where he is actually inside a living being. Like, is it in the heart or each and every cell of the body? And also, like, we also say that Krishna is everywhere in the universe, each and every pebble, everything consists of Krishna. Mm-hmm. And I just want to, I mean, like when you meditate or when you chant, you have to concentrate on Krishna who is in the heart. Yeah. And also in Bhagavad Gita, in one shloka, it was mentioned like soul and the super soul lies in the heart as like on vriksha, just like two birds kind of. So I just
from
want
the Upanishads,
to.
Katu Upanishad.
Yeah. So can you please clarify me on that?
Well, like we hear in the Brahma Samhita, Andantarasta Paramanu Chayantarastam. He exists. The universe has come from him, and then he exists at one and the same time in every single atom in the universe, because everything is a manifestation of his energy. You could think of it like fiber optics. You know, when you see there's a fiber, and then you could the light shining from the source is there at every little point in the fiber. So every piece of energy, you know, everything that exists in the world is emanating from Krishna, and therefore it's non-different from Krishna if we have that vision. But the yogis learn to meditate by practice, by meditating in the heart, and that's discussed in the second chapter of the second canto about the Lord in the heart. The first chapter is about the first step in God realization, to conceive of the universal form, and meditate on that. And then the second is about the Lord in the heart, I think. It gives a description of how the yogis meditate on him, how he's dressed, and how he's the size of a thumb, and he's present. Because we usually depict, I mean, our soul is present within our body by consciousness and exists in the entire body. We can move our body. We can wiggle our toes. We can, as long as we're healthy, wiggle our fingers. We can't wiggle our hair because we don't have. but the part of our body that feels things and stuff like that is all permeated by our consciousness, by the soul. But we conceive of the soul as being situated in this part of our body, in this core of our body, in the heart, which is not the heart organ, the muscle, but the seat of our consciousness and emotion. Even in poetry, everyone, when they talk about, well, I really felt that in my heart, there's a feeling like that's where your seat of your actual, being, Hare Krishna, your conscious being is. And that you, that soul, is also part of Krishna, part and parcel of Krishna. So he's also there with you in your heart. The Hare Krishna. you might say, the super soul, he's the self of the self. He's just like you're aware of all everything that's happening in your body, or not everything, but you're aware of what the pleasures and pains of you're feeling from your body. But the super soul is aware of everyone's body. And he's the same, you know, individual personality of Godhead, but he exists everywhere. And he's just like, you know, the sun is shining in the sky, but there's many like puddles of water, and in each puddle of water there's the sun. If you look, the reflection is there. So he's like that. He's present everywhere, even though he's actually always eternally situated in his own abode. But as Shri Dakshai Vishnu, as the super soul, he's directing the wanderings of all living beings, and he's there present in the heart, like you said, the two birds on the tree, waiting for the other bird to turn to him. The other bird is foolishly trying to enjoy the fruits of the tree and is agitated, but if he turns to his friendly bird, the peaceful bird, then he becomes peaceful also.
So is it the sixth sense that always warns us when we are doing some mistake, no, this is wrong, don't do that? Is it the sixth sense that super soul in that way is?
Yeah, we can understand that when we have a sense, the conscience, that this is wrong, or in the Freudian you know, psychoanalytical theory, they say the superego, this, you know, sense of, you know, some authority figure in the background saying, no, you're not allowed to do that. We can have an understanding that that's representative of God, and that is the super soul. But it's more than just, I mean, that's one way we can experience the super soul, as our conscience. Super soul is actually directing the wandering of all living beings and making everything work perfectly, so that according to your karma, you know, things are supposed to be happening with different people, and everything just works at the same time. There's a new movie coming out where it's Matt Damon is in it, and there's these people, these guys, they're dressed in business suits like FBI agent, government agent type guys. But it's called The Plan, I think. And they're responsible, in this fantasy movie, they're the people that are responsible for everything happening to you according to your destiny. And then I guess the hero falls in love with some girl, and this is not supposed to be part of his destiny. So there's something outside of that destiny. But, you know, this is actually true, that we have this material destiny according to actions and reactions. But our real business is in the spiritual world, which is outside of that. It's transcendental to that. It's beyond that. So but the super soul is there. Turning to the super soul means that we overcome our material destiny. Because our material destiny, whether we're going to the heavenly planets, whether we're going to the hellish planets, our material destiny is all bad. Everything material dies. Krishna says, from Brahma's loka to Patala loka, from the highest planet to the lowest planet, there's misery everywhere, and there's death everywhere. It's not real existence. That's what we were reading here, that sattvavalambi parasattvang vishuddhasattvang, that Govinda, Krishna, super soul, the form of the pure mode of goodness, is represented in the material world as the sustainer of all material things, but actually he's the underlying substantive principle of all existence, the absolute truth. So he's transcendental to the three modes of material nature. And turning to Krishna is actually a real act of freedom. And going on with our material destiny, we can understand that this is, our freedom is constricted and limited in that, you know, that we're trying to act as free, independent agents in the material world, but actually we can't become free of our destiny. We have a line in our hand that says we have to die at a certain time, and that's born with us, you know. And to overcome that, to get out of that, is to become transcendental. And then devotees are actually immortal. Actually, there's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the second canto, that says that every time the sun rises and sets, it takes away life of a human being, except for those who are chanting the holy names of Krishna, except for those who are hearing and chanting about Uttama Shloka, the Lord who is praised by choice verses. So, Ayur Harati Vaipungsam Udyanas Sanjayanaso Tasyaite Yatkananita Uttama Shloka Vartaya. So the devotees, when we're engaged in devotional service, when we're looking at the deity and singing Hare Krishna, we exist outside of time. And if we can keep our consciousness on that platform, then we don't have to take birth and death again. We will, at the time of death, we'll remember Krishna and we'll be transferred to his abode. And that existence is outside of time. So the material body may appear to die and so forth, but such a devotee is actually an eternal person, immortal. But someone who identifies with his material body has to die. Right? That's okay.
Thank you, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I have one question actually related to Mataji's question. So when I was a small kid, my grandfather died, and then at that time I heard people say that in India they say there's an Atmaram that is in the heart, and that's where the soul lives. And they say that when they look in the ashes, for some people it's still seen as a complete round, for some people it's broken. So is it true that the human soul, it resides in something?
I've never heard that. I don't know that. It may be beyond my experience or knowledge. I don't remember Srila Prabhupada ever referring to that. That looking in the ashes for the part of you that, and you can tell. But there's a lot I don't know. You know, I know that some devotees, when Prabhupada disappeared, went into samadhi or something like that, devotees were concerned about, what about, you know, rigor mortis? Does he have to, because he was put in a samadhi, so devotees were concerned that it has to be done before his body becomes stiff, because when people die, their body becomes stiff. But then the experienced devotee said, no, you don't understand. When pure devotee dies, his body never becomes stiff. He remains like that, some of these things, it's just outside of my experience. There may very well be, this may be traditional Vedic knowledge, but it's not something that I've heard about. Has any of you have any experience or knowledge of it? The Atma Rama, they called it?
Yeah, that's what I remember.
Okay, I don't know anything about it, sorry.
But we don't see the soul, we can't see the soul.
Yeah, Krishna says it's aprameya, it can't be measured.
Yeah, they say that. That's where the soul lives, not the soul itself. Yeah, but it was like I just heard when I was a kid, so it may not be like, maybe I don't remember the whole thing or whatever. It's possible.
There's in here. There's a description of guhyam, that which is confidential. That's not seen by the world, and it's situated in the heart. And there's a description of the, I don't remember which verse it is. And we'll save that for another day. But there's a description of this, you know, the use of this word of confidential or guhyam, you know, like Krishna uses in the Bhagavad Gita, that this is the Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam. And then in this Bhaktisiddhanta's book, it's talking about that which is, you know, inside a cave somewhere, inside the heart, or, you know, and that the spiritual world is also hidden like that from view, because it's the word is used to refer to that which is internal in our, but the soul is considered to exist within the heart. Or I've heard them talk about the heart cave, you know, the little place within the heart where the soul is. Maybe you've seen pictures of Hanuman tearing open his chest and showing that Rama is there, Sita Rama is there, or something like that. So there's, and in Christian iconography also, they sometimes have a picture of Jesus pointing to his sacred heart. And they have a, And it's not like a muscle with valves and stuff, but it's like a symbol of maybe like a Valentine heart or something like that. I forget, actually. Do you know? Anyone know? Yeah. The Sacred Heart, it's like a symbol of this, you know, pure love or something. Okay, we have to move on to get to the Bhagavatam class. And we're getting so late that I think we won't sing a bhajan, okay? We'll do the Namashtakam instead.